The body of the Marquis de Carabas drifted east through the deep sewer, face down. London sewers had begun their lives as rivers and streams, flowing north to south, and south of the Thames, south to north, carrying garbage, animal carcasses, and the contents of chamber pots into the Thames, which would, if it felt like it, carry the offending substances out to sea. This system had more or less worked for many years, until, in 1858, the enormous volume of effluent produced by the people and industries of London, combined with a rather hot summer, produced a phenomenon known at the time as the Great Stink. The Thames itself had become an open sewer. People who could leave London left it. The ones who stayed wrapped cloths doused in carbolic around their faces and tried not to breathe through their noses. Parliament was forced to recess early in 1858, and the following year it ordered that a program of sewer building begin. The thousands of miles of sewers that were built were constructed with a gentle slope from the west to the east, and somewhere beyond Greenwich they were pumped into the Thames estuary, and the sewage was swept off into the North Sea. It was this journey that the body of the late Marquis de Carabas was making, travelling west to east towards the sunrise and the sewage works. Rats on a high brick ledge, doing the things that rats do when no people are watching, saw the body go by. The largest of them, a big black male, chittered. A smaller brown female chittered back, then she leapt down from the ledge onto the Marquis's back and rode it down the sewer a little way, sniffing at the hair and the coat, tasting the blood, and then precariously leaning over and scrutinizing what could be seen of the face. She hopped off the head into the filthy water and swam industriously to the side, where she clambered up the slippery brickwork. She hurried back along a beam and rejoined her companions. "Belfast?" asked Richard. Dore smiled impishly and would say nothing more than, "You'll see," when he pressed her about it. He changed his tack. "How do you know that kid was telling you the truth about the market?" he asked. "It's not something anyone down here ever lies about. I don't think we can lie about it." She paused. "The market's special." "How did that kid know where it was?"
"Someone told him," said Hunter.
Richard brooded on this for a moment.
"How did they know?"
"Someone told them," explained Dore.
"But..."
He wondered who chose the locations in the first place, how the knowledge was spread, trying to frame the question in such a way that he did not sound stupid. A rich female voice asked from the darkness,
"Hss! Any idea when the next market is?"
She stepped into the light. She wore silver jewellery, and her dark hair was perfectly coiffed. She was very pale, and her long dress was jet black velvet. Richard knew immediately that he had seen her before, but it took him a few moments to place her. The first floating market, that was it, in Harrods. She had smiled at him.
"Tonight," said Hunter. "Belfast."
"Thank you," said the woman. She had the most amazing eyes, thought Richard. They were the colour of foxgloves.
"I'll see you there,"
she said, and she looked at Richard as she said it. Then she looked away, a little shyly. She stepped into the shadows and she was gone.
"Who was that?" asked Richard.
"They call themselves Velvets," said Dore. "They sleep down here during the day and walk the upworld at night."
"Are they dangerous?" asked Richard.
"Everybody's dangerous," said Hunter.
"Look," said Richard, "going back to the market, who decides where it gets held and when, and how do the first people find out where it's being held?"
Hunter shrugged.
"Dore?"
he asked.
"I've never thought about it."
They turned a corner. Dore held up her lamp.
Not bad at all, said Dor.
And fast, too, said Hunter. She touched the painting on the rock wall with her fingertip. The paint was still wet. It was a painting of Hunter and Dor and Richard. It was not flattering.
The black rat entered the lair of the golden deferentially, his head lowered, ears back. He crawled forward, squeeing and chittering. The golden had made their lair in a pile of bones. This pile of bones had once belonged to a woolly mammoth, back in the cold times when the great hairy beasts walked across the snowy tundra of the south of England as if, in the opinion of the golden, they owned the place. This particular mammoth, at least, had been disabused of that idea rather thoroughly and quite terminally by the golden. The black rat made its obeisance at the base of the bone pile. Then he lay on his back with his throat exposed, closed his eyes and waited. After a while, a chittering from above told him that he could roll over. One of the golden crawled out of the mammoth skull on the top of the heap of bones. It crawled along the old ivory tusk, a golden-furred rat with copper-coloured eyes, the size of a large house cat. The black rat spoke. The golden thought, briefly, and chattered an order. The black rat rolled on his back, exposing his throat again for a moment. Then a twist and a wriggle, and he was on his way.